the Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight, addressing an OPCW meeting. Syria's mission to the UN body said the actions of the Global Chemical Weapons Watchdog contradicts the principles of impartiality, since the United States has the largest chemical arsenal in the world and the munitions pose a grave threat to international peace and security. The US, France, and Britain have long accused Syria of using chemical weapons against its people. This is while Syria surrendered its stockpile of chemical weapons back in 2014 to a joint mission led by the US and the OPCW, which oversaw the destruction of the weaponry. For more on that, we're joined by our correspondent, Mohammed Ali, who's with us from the Syrian capital, Damascus. Mohammed, welcome to the program. Please tell us more about these recent comments coming from Damascus.
Yes, actually, the comments were from came out from the head of Syria's mission at the OPCW in a meeting there. Rani Al-Rifai said that the OPCW has turned from a technical organization into a political tool in the hands of the United States, France, Britain, and other Western countries that have been implementing policies in line with the U.S. ones in order to pressure Syria and falsely accuse it various accusations, such as still having chemical weapons over here. Now, also, Rani Al-Rifai said that Syria fulfilled all of its commitments when it joined the OPCW back in 2013. And, of course, we all remember how the international community acknowledged that Syria destroyed all of its chemical weapons. However, we still continue to hear accusations by the West that Syria still has chemical substances. Now, we also have to point out that head of Syria's mission, Rani Al-Rifai, also criticized those claims by the United States and its allies that claim that Syria has chemical weapons, saying that those are lies and fabrications. Also, a very important point is Syria always argues and asks a question. Whenever those countries accuse Syria, Syria was in a state of advancing, Syria's army was advancing against terrorists. So there's a question. Why would a country like Syria use chemical weapons when, one, it has no chemical weapons, two, the ordinary weapons were doing the job against the terrorists?
All right, thanks a lot, Mohammed Ali, joining us from Damascus. Let's take a look at our guests for tonight's Spotlight. We have veteran war zone correspondent and political analyst with over 35 years of experience covering West Asia, North Africa, Mr. Elijah Magnea, joining us from Brussels. And also expert on West Asian affairs and former British ambassador to Syria, Peter Ford, joins us from Manchester. Let's start off with Mr. Ford in Manchester. Sir, Syria says that the Global Chemical Weapons Watchdog is no longer a technical organization, but a political tool in the hands of the United States, the UK, and France to exert pressure on Damascus. How do you view these comments?
Yes, sadly, I have to agree 100% with that take on the OPCW. It's a tragedy that this very important international monitoring body should be corrupted in this way by being politicized by Western powers. The OPCW should be playing an impartial role and should be seen to be extremely impartial, but for the last few years, in decision after decision, it has shown that it is a puppet of the Western powers. Now, Britain and America in particular are responsible here. They have stuffed this organization with seconded officials from their own administrations who do not respect the impartiality of the OPCW, but carry out the wishes of their masters in Washington and London. And this is basically why the OPCW is well on the way to being completely discredited.
Well, the organization's first president, Brazilian diplomat José Bustani, he backed and expressed his grave concerns over the tampering of the 2018 Duma report, fearing that the OPCW had become a tool of the U.S. government. Give us your take on those comments from the former head of the organization. Those are pretty much identical to what Damascus is saying right now.
Well, he's absolutely right, Mr. Bustani, and he's well placed to know, given his previous position. But I'm afraid in the UN system, and I used to work in the UN after I left the British diplomatic service, I'm afraid in today's UN, if you don't follow the US narrative on important issues, you will never get to be Director General of an organization like OPCW. This organization and other agencies of the UN have become highly politicized by the Western powers just in the last 15 years. And he's absolutely correct that the initial report done by the technical inspectors who went to Duma produced a clear conclusion that there was no evidence of a chemical weapons attack. And this report was, once it got to headquarters in The Hague, was doctored by the Western officials working within the office of the Director General to produce the opposite conclusion. Why? Well, in order to justify the bombing of Syria, which has taken place even without waiting for the investigation by the US, by the OPCW inspectors.
Let's cross over now to Elijah Magnier in Brussels. Mr. Magnier, revelations, they suggest that the OPCW may have intentionally doctored its findings about the alleged gas attacks in Syria. The scandal, as we know, continued to grow throughout 2020 as OPCW experts. They came forward, they gave testimony as to how their findings had been completely manipulated or ignored in order to present a one-sided or quote-unquote incorrect view of events in order to further an agenda. Is that what Damascus meant when it repeatedly urged the chemical weapons watchdog to avoid politicizing Syrian issues?
Indeed. As your guest said, rightly said, the OPCW is politicized. And when Jose Bustani came out with his narrative saying that we are, the inspectors are technical and scientists, and according to the scientist opinion, there is no chemical attack on Duma. And the reason why the OPCW is insisting is to justify the US, UK, and France attack on Damascus. And the whole world watched how the OPCW is lacking trust these days, particularly after the Duma attack. And it is obvious that a lot of pressure was put on the organization that needs honest watchdog and need honest observer and scientists to go on the site and tell us what's happening, but without taking a side and without being doctrinized by the superpower or the US or the UK opinion. Otherwise, there is no need for them to go and inspect on the ground if the decision is made before the attack.
I'm going to stay with you, Mr. Magnier. Why would the OPCW, even under pressure, suppress information and its findings? Just thinking about the consequences, what would this do to the body's credibility?
The aim was to attack President Assad that was winning a large part of Syria and freeing most of his territory. And when the international community that worked very hard to overthrow President Assad and allow Al-Qaeda and ISIS to gain territory, notwithstanding the huge investment that the Western countries and many Gulf countries, including Turkey, invested in Syria, it was just an excuse to look for, to bomb President Assad, even though everybody knows that at the time of the bombing in 2018, it was too late to change the balance on the ground. So bombing for bombing, it didn't make any sense. And regardless, the US, UK, and France went ahead and bombed three positions, and they told us that they were chemical sites. I mean, how can you bomb chemical sites and not risk the spread of chemical products and material in the air that can affect everybody, including civilians in Syria, it didn't make absolutely no sense.
Peter Ford, Damascus, along with Russia, have said in the past that chemical attacks had been staged in Syria in order to incriminate Damascus. There are a lot of arguments that Douma was a false flag attack. Who benefits from these actions? The cover-ups, the alleged false flag attacks, who gains from all of this?
The Western powers and the so-called rebels, obviously. The Western powers needed to justify their illegal bombing of Syria. That's why they can never admit that it was carried out on the basis of a falsehood. That's why they must continue to sustain this lie. But there's another deeper and more topical reason. They have to justify the continuing war on Syria, which mainly takes the form of economic warfare in the shape of sanctions and withholding reconstruction assistance. In order to continue these cruel sanctions, which penalize and punish the ordinary Syrian people, the Western powers have to maintain the narrative that Assad is the president who gasses his people. So this fakery is the cornerstone of the propaganda strategy which underpins the economic warfare on Syria, and that continues, and that's why they continue to hound Syria over this non-issue of chemical weapons.
Elijah Magnier, same question to you. If you recall, Russia recently warned of possible upcoming false flag attacks to maybe justify exerting more pressure on Damascus. Who actually benefits from all of this?
Well, as Peter rightly said, the only beneficial is just to keep sustaining the narrative of what the U.S. is offering us, including the EU, to impose sanctions on Syria. And now the U.S. and the EU don't have any politics or any strategy to carry on in Syria. All their options are bad from their point of view. So what they are doing is to starve the population and thinking that maybe with sanctions they can curb the public opinion and turn it against President Assad, or perhaps they force Assad to come and negotiate with them. And this is not going to happen. The people are getting used to very harsh sanctions, and they are suffering. The local currency is devalued. All the goods are extremely unaffordable for everybody in Syria. And what the only benefit is, just because the Americans don't have any clear policy, they don't know what to do, to stay or to leave. So what they do is they maintain the sanction under very different excuses, including the chemical attack.
Peter Ford, there were a lot of, the scandal coming out of the Douma attack, there was a lot of calls for reinvestigating the evidence. Instead of reopening the investigation into places like Douma, the OPCW took a step further and suspended Syria's rights at the weapons watchdog, citing a lack of cooperation. The question is, why should Syria cooperate with the OPCW at all?
That's a very good and fair question. The OPCW, since Douma, or the Americans and the British and the French have tried to give new powers and create new investigating committees and groups and sub-bodies over which they themselves will have more control, all in order to keep up the pressure on Syria and to some extent Russia, and to keep trying to exploit this issue. But the fact remains that the inspectors have only been able to carry out one proper investigation into an alleged site of an alleged use of chemical weapons, and that was Douma. And in that case, the first group of scientists and technical experts found that there was no evidence of a chemical attack. And this is why the Western powers have to keep trying to create new groups which will be more amenable to manipulation. It's no wonder that Syria simply refuses to have anything to do with them. They're illegal anyway. They've been set up, these new investigative bodies, they've been set up illegally in terms of UN law.
Elijah Magnier, when the OPCW scandals were unfolding, one journalist took to social media writing that this should be a global scandal. Quote, the suppression of evidence from experts from the OPCW in order to push for war in Syria. This cover-up was ignored by mainstream media. Why was it ignored?
Because there is no accountability for whatever superpower and countries like the US, UK, and France are doing in Syria. Their presence is illegal, and the mainstream media is supporting them because they've been bombarded by the necessity to remove President Assad from power. Everybody has adopted this narrative, and the consequences were unimportant. At the end of the day, after 11 years or 10 years of war, the President Assad is still in power and the Syrian government is stable. Now they're not willing to back off and change the narrative. This is why they don't care about scandal. If the OPCW has lost credibility or not, all world leaders have lost credibility in Syria, not only in Syria, even in other parts of the Middle East. Therefore, this is no longer something that we can, those searching for the truth or voicing the truth can do much about it, at the exception of just mentioning it and just saying it. And the other side is just even closing their eyes or pursuing the same narrative.
Peter Ford, one last question for you. Here's a concerning thought. If the likes of the U.S., the U.K., France, etc., they can pressure the OPCW for their own agendas, then they could very well be doing the same with other international bodies, too. Give us your final thoughts.
Absolutely. And thankfully, much of the world is waking up to this danger. Interestingly, 29 countries all around the world voted against the April suspension of Syria's voting rights in OPCW. That's 29 countries who are very alive, I'm sure, to the danger that you just mentioned, that this could be just the beginning of how the international system is manipulated against them and not just Syria.
All right, thanks a lot. Allow me to thank my guest, Mr. Elijah Magnier, joining us from Brussels. Also, thanks to former British Ambassador to Syria, Peter Ford, joining us from Manchester. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now, and see you next time.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, let there be light. And there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image and then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint. A critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. A warm welcome to the program Viewpoint on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. And in this or in this series of the program Viewpoint, we are criticizing movies with religious themes. And so far we have talked about a lot of movies hovering around the topic of cloning with our dear guest, Sayyid Abdullah, and Brother Hussein. Assalamu alaikum, Sayyid Abdullah, and welcome to the studio again.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And Brother Hussein, assalamu alaikum to you, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam, I'm glad to be here.
Welcome. Well, today, let's focus on another one of those movies with the subject of modern technological advancement, such as cloning. And that is none movie, but Replicas. Well, it's a 2018 American science fiction thriller. It's about a brilliant neuroscientist who loses his wife, son, and two daughters in a tragic car accident. Using a very cutting-edge technology, comes up with a daring and unprecedented plan to download their memories and manage to clone their bodies too. As the experiment begins to spiral out of control, he soon finds himself at odds with his dubious boss, a reluctant accomplice or a lab assistant, a police task force, and the physical laws of science. And then the plot goes on and develop in a very complicated and amazing way. Well, this is directed by Jeffrey Nachmanoff, with very famous Hollywood star Keanu Reeves, and then Alice Eve, Thomas Milton, John Ortiz, and so on and so forth. All right. Let me begin with you, Brother Hussein. What do you think of the movie?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So the movie Replicas, I thought it was an overall good movie.
Mm-hmm.
Bad production, but it was a good movie. I felt like it was very exciting. It had like this thriller type of vibe to it. And, mm-hmm. You know, and one thing that I noticed was that there was like a very apparent undertone of awkwardness. There was like a lot of, you know, like some major plot twists and plot holes
mm-hmm.
in the movie that didn't really make sense. Some of them were illogical. But yeah, it was overall a pretty good movie.
Very good. And Sayyid Abdullah?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In my opinion, it was just one of these standard movies. There's nothing to it. It's very typical. The guy's trying to create something. He's stuck. He needs a motivation, so his wife has to die. So he's motivated to clone his wife. So it's very, I don't know, in my opinion, it was very dull, very basic, very straightforward. And pretty much you can tell where the movie was going from the beginning.
Yes.
Like, it doesn't require a genius. So it didn't have any anything special, anything new, or anything even exciting.
But in comparison with the previous movies like Andover, that the biologist tried to clone his wife, this neuroscientist attempts to clone not only his wife, but also his whole family.
So the concept of cloning is still there, so we're yes. not discussing that concept. That's a different issue. But as a movie in general, I mean, yeah, you obviously have the cloning process, you have the kids, she has to choose which one to clone out of his kids as well.
Yes.
So all these aspects, like I said, aside, as a movie in general, as a whole, it didn't have anything. They tried to dramatize it, make mm-hmm. it like a yes. Brother Hussein said, like yes. a thriller kind of type, but I don't think that worked.
Uh-huh,
it's just, it was very typical, very predictable. I don't know.
It could be just me. Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Okay. Before we continue our discussion, let's take a break and we'll be back.
We got a donor inbound, 37 minutes.
Time since cardiac death?
7 hours, 15 minutes.
Proceed. Initiate sequence. We are going to replicate the human mind.
to take his biological brain, imprint it into that synthetic brain. Stand by to initiate neural imprint. All functions go.
Back to the program Viewpoint with me, Mohammad Javad, on RIB English Radio. And our dear guests, Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Hussein. We are talking about the movie Replicas, an American science fiction thriller with Keanu Reeves in it. Well, Brother Hussein, this movie, don't you think, deals more or delves more deeply into the idea of cloning in comparison with the other movies that we criticized in the previous episodes?
Yeah, actually, I feel like this movie had a much more scientific and like real feel to it,
mm-hmm.
Than the other movies. This one was, you know, it looked cooler, I guess. It mm-hmm. looked more, you know, fact based rather than the other movies. Like, for example, what was that one? The old one. No, the oldest one.
The Sixth Day?
Yeah. Like, he puts a CD inside the guy's head. It didn't yes. really make sense. But this one, you know, it had more of a, like, a logical touch to it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I guess this one was probably the best one in terms of cloning out of all of the other movies that I've seen.
I see. Sayyid Abdullah, how about you?
I would disagree.
Uh-huh, okay.
My opinion is that it's completely, so what they were trying to do is, like, from the beginning, they were trying to, as they call it, they're trying to map the conscious of a person and move it to a robot, right? When that failed, so he said, well, let me do the cloning process, which is with the same concept of image mapping and then transferring the conscious.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just ridiculous. Like, you just inject a needle in the brain and suck the information out of it. How does that work? It's not like you have information, like, they're not blood cells that you can just suck and turn them into data.
You don't really suck them, though. Like you copy the information. You copy the map.
How?
Well, of course, by their technology.
Yeah, so they did not come up with a method. See, if they left the needle away, it would have made more sense. Like, you have a device in your head that could map mm-hmm. your head and, I don't know, extract information magically, scientifically, right? So it would have made more sense than sticking a needle in your eye.
Yes. But what about those documentaries that, in fact, deals with the issue? Like, they have actually devised some kind of a devices, you know, mm-hmm. and then they connected, like, EEG things.
Yeah, so, like, stuff. It sucks like the Matrix style. Like,
exactly.
The Matrix, like, you just...
Not even like that physically, but they put some, what do you call it, needles or some stuff on your head, and then it tries to, like, what do you call it, transcribe, for example, your brain waves or something like that.
Yeah,
and
so
then
they hit like, they do that with the Chinese medicine where they put needles and they hit certain nerves and your brain interacts to them. So, like I said, that's...
But more electronically.
More electronically. Than, so you, yeah. even if, you, let's say, that's what I'm saying, if we had a device that could, for example... uses the waves in your brain and then turns them into digital information and stored, would have been more acceptable a science fiction story than a needle goes through your eye. Mm-hmm. For this is from my perspective.
Yeah, of course.
So, and that's the one thing. The other thing is, like, how could you transfer consciousness? You know, it's like cloning a body is one thing, transferring a consciousness is another. With other movies, they did not attempt to transfer consciousness. Right? They said, well, we're creating a new, like with the Robert De Niro movie, right?
Yes.
Godsend,
yeah.
So they were trying to create a new creation,
uh-huh.
a new person.
Yes.
Well, this one, no. You have the body made in a cube, and then the soul injected into it and through a device.
Yes.
So it, I don't know. Even from a science fiction perspective, it didn't go very well if we have to be more like, you know, precise when it comes to even though it's science fiction. But like I said before, it has to be, you know, a bit you can digest, I guess.
You so mean it's awkward to understand.
Very awkward. Like, you know, you have a person and then you inject something into them through a digital device.
Okay. Let's take a break and we'll be back.
Stand by for commitment.
Tissue intact.
intact. Protoplasmic integrity looks good. We have a viable cortex. Do you concur?
I concur.
Ball's in your court, Wynn.
This man is dead. Yet his neurological data is still accessible. We are going to take his biological brain, imprint it into that synthetic brain, replicate the human mind. Ed, boot the mapping sequence.
Optical positioning optimal.
Target acquired. Lackable targeting complete. Stand by to engage neural probe.
Stand by for neural probe.
Back to the program Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio with me, Mohammad Jawad, hosting. And our dear guests are still Brother Hussein and Sayyid Abdullah. Brother Hussein, in the earlier part of this episode, Sayyid Abdullah made a very good point about the consciousness. And he said that he criticized the movie, the whole movie, and based on the fact that, well, how do we approach this consciousness? We can't digest or we can't understand. There is no method, basically, of injecting that kind of consciousness into the body, right, yeah, in comparison with the other movies. So what do you say?
In terms of consciousness, I feel like what Brother Abdullah was trying to say is that, you know, we copy the brain map, right, and then we insert it into the clone.
Mm-hmm.
Consciousness is not something that you can transfer. It's something that comes after you give the body life, mm-hmm, right?
Yes.
And it has to be, you know, it comes about with very, you know, peculiar circumstances. It doesn't just come like that. Of course, that being said, okay, there are, I guess, ways to transfer consciousness,
yes,
in a way. But, you know, it's not really, that's not what they're talking about in the movie. That's not how it works in the movie. They take the map of the brain, they take who the person was, and then they inject it into the clone, and then they regain consciousness,
yes,
at their own pace, at their own time.
I see. How do you reconcile or, like, compare and contrast consciousness and soul?
Well, the consciousness, I feel it has to do with the soul waking up too. Because when the soul leaves the body doesn't really work, right? It's like...
medically dead.
Yeah, it's like basically medically dead. But, yes, of course, your soul is still there. It's out and about. The thing is, the soul is like a car and its driver. So the driver is the soul and the car is the body. And when, you know, when the soul leaves the body, then, you know, the car doesn't drive by itself. But when the soul goes back, when the driver goes back into the car, they turn on the key, the car becomes, you know, quote unquote, conscious. So that's how I feel it works with us. You know, the soul presses a couple of buttons, we start moving a couple of fingers, we open our eyes, and we start feeling again, we start living again.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, in this movie, there is no explanation to how the soul came back or how, you know, all of that stuff. It's all very, it's a very, you know, atheist perspective movie, I guess.
I see. We are actually, unfortunately, coming to the end of this episode, but there are lots of questions that I like to ask you, hopefully, or God willing, I'm going to do so, in fact, in the upcoming episodes. You were listening to the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program, on RIB English Radio with me, Mohammad Jawad, the host of this program, and my dear guest in this episode were Brother Hussein and Sayyid Abdullah. Thank you very much for listening to us.
follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
Around the world with reporters.
On Wednesday in the Italian capital, humanitarian activists gathered outside the Italian parliament to stage a protest against an anti-migration deal between Rome and Tripoli. The protest, dubbed a blindfold to avoid seeing the truth, was called by a number of NGOs ahead of a crucial parliamentary vote on the renewal of the accord. Protesters were saying the deal has been causing suffering to tens of thousands of refugees since its signing in 2017.
Under the deal, Italy helps Libyan maritime authorities to stop boats at sea and return the illegal migrants to detention centers in Libya. At least 50,000 people, including thousands of children, have been returned to the northern African country so far. However, the condition in Libya is a matter of concern as they face detention and serious abuse, including rape and torture.
I think it's not a problem, unfortunately, only of the Italian government and the country. It's a European problem, and the European policies, basically, Europe endorses the Italian initiative.
During the protest, activists read messages of desperation sent by the refugees trapped in war-ravaged Libya. Some refugees have unsuccessfully attempted to cross the Mediterranean up to 3-4 times.
Facciamo finta di non vedere cosa succede.
We keep turning a blind eye to what is happening in Libya. The decision to renew the deal is a shameful display of how far EU governments are prepared to go to keep refugees and migrants from Europe's shores.
C'è una parte della politica italiana.
Here in Italy, some politicians deal with the migrants as if they were enemies at the gates, creating fear among Italians. The other politicians make sure not to create too much discomfort to their electorate.
Some lawmakers who attended the protest also said that an Italian Navy ship docked in Tripoli has even directly coordinated the intercepting activities carried out on the refugee boats by the Libyan Coast Guard. Later on Wednesday, Foreign Minister Luigi Di Maio told the House that Italy will no more fund the Libyan Coast Guard to encourage a management of migrant flows that is more respectful of international norms by Tripoli. Max Civili, Rome.
Bagram Air Base in northern Parwan province was known as the main U.S. military headquarter in Afghanistan over the past 20 years. This is why experts have blamed the U.S. for wasting international aids to Afghanistan by building America's largest military base in the country.
The U.S. has built Bagram military base by wasting international aids that were earmarked for modernization of the Afghan National Army and the country's development. The airbase is now vacated without U.S. achieving its goals.
As this army general says, the U.S. forces informed Afghans of their pullout earlier, but set no exact time for their departure.
Early morning, once we received some rumors that U.S. Army left the Bagram, we increased our intelligence and our reports. We got that, yes, they left the Bagram, and after that we entered to the base and took the all towers and secure inside of the Bagram as well.
After talking to the ANA commander, we headed to former symbol of U.S. military power in Afghanistan, Bagram Air Base, a parking lot is located at one of the four entrances of the air base. The U.S. forces have left many of these vehicles behind. Afghan forces say U.S. forces have disabled the electronic systems of these military vehicles instead of disabling the war machine of Taliban.
Now, Afghan officials said they are going to fix such military vehicles to use them in fighting against terrorism across Afghanistan.
After crossing the entrance gate, we faced a real American town where U.S. forces have spent long nights and days despite failing to achieve their major stated goal that was uprooting terrorism here. Now, Afghans are in charge of such mission. Having control over Bagram helps Afghan forces to effectively manage and launch counter-terrorism operations against terrorist groups. It seems that the U.S. forces had access to high technology, emergency protection measures and welfare amenities in different parts of this airfield to reduce the level of harm, particularly the psychological harm that was coming from the Afghan war to U.S. forces. For instance, this gas station had been supplying fuel to hundreds of big generators across the air base. Afghan forces have collected these GEM tools from different GEMs located in Bagram, saying the U.S. forces had access to not only GEMs, but also to cinema and restaurants as well. Despite being equipped with a modern air defense system protecting Bagram Air Base during U.S. military presence here, emergency exitways like this one served as a central part of the base. Meanwhile, there have been hundreds of hideouts like this one built by American troops to protect them against possible Taliban rocket attacks. Visiting residential buildings of the U.S. forces in Bagram is also a need. But the bitter fact is that Afghan forces even do not have access to the codes of some doors of the residential buildings in Bagram. So they have no way but to use things like this chair to keep the doors open.
And here is a residential room that was used by American soldiers in the Bagram military air base.
The presence of meal packages, air conditioner systems, refrigerators, microwaves, internet access and TVs that have been left in residential areas by the U.S. forces once again proves that how big difference was and is between a foreign military soldier and an Afghan soldier. There are also many warehouses like this food warehouse in Bagram. Bagram Hospital is the other destination for us. The modern hospital is dark now and we need to use either torches or our camera light to see what is inside. The flame of Washington's longest war in Afghanistan hospitalized thousands of U.S. soldiers in rooms like this one. These beds, medicines, and medical equipment could save the lives of thousands of wounded U.S. troops. But hundreds of them lost their lives here in Bagram Hospital and never returned back to the U.S. due to severe injuries. And now, with rising insecurity in Afghanistan, only time will tell whether or not the Afghan government can make this strategic air base operational due to shortage of financial resources. Syed Amin Alami, Bagram Air Base in Northern Parwan Province.
The Iranian government has expressed anger over the participation of Italian politician Franco Frattini to a hybrid virtual and face-to-face meeting hosted by terror organization MKO in Albania last weekend. MKO is seen by geopolitical experts as a dangerous sectarian group that was on the list of terrorist organizations of the EU and the US for several years. Despite that, a number of international figures, including former U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and former Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper, have given their full support for this group.
The truth is that the MKO has always been instrumental to the geopolitical strategies of Western countries. It's been designated as a terrorist organization for many years, and its delisting was very much linked to a plan to increase pressure on Tehran. This only shows the double standards of the West when it comes to terrorist groups. MKO's collusion with the US and the Israeli intelligence is a known fact.
Frattini is a former European Commissioner and Foreign Minister under two Berlusconi governments between 2002 and 2011. as the head of Italy's foreign affairs, in 2003 he sent an Italian military and police contingent to Iraq and Afghanistan in support of the US hegemonic influence in the Middle East. Frattini currently holds the post of director of the prestigious Italian Society for International Organization, a non-profit body operating under the supervision of the Italian Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Contacted by Press TV, the former Italian minister has declined to comment on its appearance at the MKO event held in Albania.
Frattini's participation in the MKO's annual conference comes as no surprise. Some governments interacting with terrorist organizations to avoid boots-on-the-ground combat operations need well-known political figures who support them to validate their illegal actions.
Iran has summoned the ambassador of Slovenia to Tehran to voice protest at the Slovenian Prime Minister Janez Janša's participation in the anti-Iran virtual gathering organized by the MKO. In an official letter of protest, Tehran has called the Slovenian Prime Minister's move unacceptable and undiplomatic.
Ties between Italy and Iran have been forever connoted by consistent mutual empathy, to the point that not even the US unilaterally imposed sanctions completely stopped their relations. Rome has long been Tehran's main trade partner, and hundreds of Italian companies are looking forward to fully resuming trade with Iran. Max Civili, Rome.
A Yemeni rights advocacy group called the Eye of Humanity Center for Rights and Development has released a new report that highlights the destruction of Yemen's infrastructure in over 6 years of war by Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies.
The bombardment of civilian areas by the Saudi-led coalition's warplanes and artillery units have turned more than 500,000 homes into ruin. The attacks have also targeted 15 airports across Yemen, turning them non-operational. The seaports in the impoverished country, which are the only lifeline for people, have not been spared either. 16 Yemeni ports have been damaged in the coalition airstrikes. The ongoing Saudi-led military campaign has also resulted in the total or partial destruction of 391 hospitals or health facilities.
An important part of the report also highlights the number of victims of the Saudi-led war. The advocacy group says more than 43,000 Yemenis have been either killed or injured in the conflict.
17,176 people have been killed in Saudi-led attacks on Yemen. These include more than 3,800 children and 2,400 women. 26,700 people have also been wounded. These include over 4,200 children and 2,800 women.
Children have sustained a significant number of casualties in Saudi-led attacks. Yet the United Nations last month, in a controversial move, added Yemen's Ansarullah movement to its 2021 list of violators of children's rights. That sparked condemnations with Yemen's political leadership, saying that such a move by the world body is detached from realities on the ground and is not based on independent reports. Last year, the UN removed the Saudi-led coalition from the list of shame, an annual blacklist of parties violating children's rights. That despite the UN's own investigators found the coalition of killing or injuring hundreds of children in its relentless bombing campaign on the impoverished nation. Saudi Arabia was first included on the blacklist in 2016, but the decision was reversed shortly after the kingdom threatened to cut off funding to UN programs. The UN this year excluded Saudi Arabia from the list not to antagonize the kingdom again. Riyadh, along with some of its allies and backed by the West, has been bombing Yemen since 2015. It has also imposed an all-out blockade on the country. These have resulted in the world's biggest humanitarian crisis in Yemen, where 2 in 3 people, according to the UN, need help to survive, and children are dying from entirely preventable causes in their thousands. According to Yemen's health ministry, at least one child dies every 5 minutes as a result of Saudi siege or attacks. The extent of casualties and damage reveals the brutality of the Saudi-led coalition toward Yemen. Still, the West and the UN continue to show their double standard when it comes to Yemen and embolden Saudi Arabia to continue committing crimes. It seems what matters the most is Saudi petrodollars, not the loss of innocent human lives.
president, Jovenel Moïse, was killed during an attack on his private residence in the capital, Port-au-Prince, last Wednesday. No guard was injured in the attack. Officials have not yet explained how the killers got past Moïse's security detail. They have not said anything about the possible motive behind the assassination either. Haitian police say 28 people were involved in the attack. Three are Haitian Americans who have been arrested. The rest, all Colombian, remain at large. The Colombian Defense Ministry says initial findings suggest that several of the attackers have been retired members of the Colombian military. On Monday, Haitian police said they had caught the mastermind behind the assassination. They said the suspect had used a Florida-based security firm to hire mercenaries to kill the president. Washington has said the evidence provided by the Haitian authorities indicates that the assassination plot was at least partly hatched in the United States. Meanwhile, American television CNN said several of the men involved in Moïse's assassination were previously working as U.S. law enforcement informants. CNN cited people briefed on the matter. The U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration told it that at least one of the arrested suspects was a confidential source to the administration. Other suspects also had U.S. ties, including working as informants for the FBI. However, the FBI said in response to CNN's reporting that it doesn't comment on informants. A simple history check reveals deep U.S. involvement in Haiti. In 1915, following the assassination of the then Haitian president, the U.S. sent Marines into the tiny island nation. Washington gained complete control over the Haitian finances and the right to intervene there whenever the U.S. government deemed it necessary. This occupation continued until 1934. With Haiti having a track record of interference from Western governments like the U.S., it remains to be seen whether the country will be able to preserve peace and stability as it goes through this transformation.
Disgusting scenes coincided with England's historic defeat against Italy in the Euro 2020 football competition, as fights, vandalism and racism were recorded both before and after full time. The majority of the racism was online and aimed at three black players who failed to score vital penalty kicks, costing England the game. The flood of hate forced even the Prime Minister to speak out against it.
Major clean-up operations taking place just outside Wembley Stadium after the scenes we saw. Many would have hoped that we would have seen an end to hooliganism in the football industry. It was once dubbed the English disease, but it appears after the scenes we saw yesterday that we have some way to go before we can class the English disease as being totally extinct from the industry.
Footage recorded outside the stadium showed mobs of ticketless fans storm past the gates, gaining illegal entry, only to be met by a rival mob of fans fighting to keep them out. While the once clean streets of central London was turned into a giant rubbish tip by frustrated fans lashing out.
The reaction from England fans was both entirely predictable and in keeping with long-standing English traditions of extreme violence and disorder upon defeat. I mean, to support England means to support this sort of behaviour. I think it's an essential part of the supporter culture of the national team. You know, you can't really get more English than spiteful violence to make up for one's own deficiencies. The authorities don't exist to protect minorities, but to punish us. And what I found more disturbing was the number of black and brown people supporting England, you know, out of ignorance, a misplaced sense of identity, self-hatred. This should be a wake-up call for them.
These actions have now led to a Football Association review of England's conduct and condemnation by the London Metropolitan Police. However, if fans can't be properly held in check, England could risk major fines or even be banned from competing in the future. Robert Carter, London.
Yet another attempt by a banned terrorist organization at rebranding itself as a legitimate opposition group in exile. The Mujahideen Khalq organization, known as the MKO, which held its annual gathering in Albania, featuring generously paid politicians and former government officials from the US and Europe, giving carefully worded speeches in person or online. Among them, former British Parliament Speaker John Bercow, the man who recently defected the Conservative Party for Labour after launching a withering attack on his erstwhile party member, Prime Minister Boris Johnson. We reached out to Mr. Bercow's media representative requesting for clarification regarding his involvement with the MEK. Received an automated response saying they would be in touch shortly. We are yet to hear from them.
I think our politicians need to be careful about how they behave, and that's politicians of all colours. And I think, unfortunately, they're really stretching the bounds of ethics and what it is to be a public servant, which is very unfortunate.
Former politicians speaking at the MEK's annual gatherings is not without precedent. Over the years, the terror cult has splashed out sizable sums of money to enlist the support of people in power on both sides of the Atlantic. Most notably, former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton paid upwards of $40,000 per speech in 2018.
Only three reasons can explain why the former Speaker of the British House of Commons might speak to the MKO. Either he literally doesn't know of the thousands and thousands of people this terrorist organization has killed, or he doesn't care about that, or the money was so tempting that it became more important than any moral objection to the MKO.
The MKO, who used to be based in a large military garrison in Iraq, fought against Iran alongside Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s and provided material and intelligence support in a conflict that lasted eight long years and left hundreds of thousands dead, injured, or displaced on either side. In 2000, they were designated as a terrorist organization. 12 years later, the U.S. government removed them from a list of terrorist organizations, and in 2013, the terrorist group relocated to a vast and tightly guarded barracks in Albania that few outsiders have ever entered.
Experts say to see former American and European officials support a known terrorist organization in return for money speaks to the double standard exercised by those individuals when it comes to the issue of terrorism. Saeed Puriza, London.
There seems to be no end at sight to tensions within the United States and China. In the latest development, China's military announced it drove away a U.S. warship that it said illegally entered Chinese waters near the disputed Paracel Islands. It also urged Washington to stop such provocative actions. In reaction, the U.S. Navy claimed that the USS Benfold asserted navigational rights and freedoms in the vicinity of the Paracel Islands. It also dismissed China's claim of a serious violation of its sovereignty as false and a misrepresentation. The U.S. move coincided with the fifth anniversary of an international arbitral ruling that favored the Philippines and invalidated China's maritime claims in the South China Sea. Beijing has consistently dismissed the tribunal's finding. Regarding the occasion, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken called on Beijing to stop what he called aggressive acts in the South China Sea. Blinken said that freedom of the seas was an enduring interest of all nations.
Nowhere is the rules-based maritime order under greater threat than in the South China Sea. The People's Republic of China continues to coerce and intimidate Southeast Asian coastal states, threatening freedom of navigation in this critical global thruway.
The South China Sea has become a major bone of contention between Beijing and Washington over the past years. The U.S. routinely sends warships and warplanes to the region to assert what it calls its right to freedom of navigation, ratcheting up tensions among the countries in the region. China has constantly warned the U.S. over its military activities in the contested waters. Beijing and Washington are also at odds over a range of issues, including China's policies with regard to Hong Kong and Taiwan, as well as their trade policies and origins of the COVID-19 pandemic. Amid strained relations between the two sides, there have been fears that the South China Sea could emerge as a potential flashpoint. China had hoped for an improvement in relations under U.S. President Joe Biden, who succeeded Donald Trump in January. But a new administration has shown no sign of backing down on Trump's hardline policies toward China.